Hello, ladies and gents. Welcome to How to Get Away with Law, an unofficial podcast for the hit ABC show How to Get Away with Murder. And we'll be talking about Season 2, Episode 6, called Two Birds, One Millstone. And first off, I'm going to apologize in advance for this episode coming out late. Yesterday was crazy and busy, so I apologize. Anyway, enough with apologizing. Now on to the recapping. And a disclaimer. This recap is not of my own making, because ABC has gotten skimpy on the recaps, so I just go around the internet, just perusing people's recaps. I don't exactly read them beforehand. I just decided, hey, it's better than me recapping them and you having to read my recaps, or listening to my recaps, and then me boring you with my thoughts at the other end of it. So I'll just read somebody else's recap in my own voice, and then respond to it later. So this one we get from www.refinery29.com. This recap is written by Annie Barrett. So let's hope this one's a good one and get into this week's recap of Two Birds, One Millstone. First, Wes would like to break the fourth wall with the disclaimer, none of this makes sense. We know, puppy. We know. But we're crazy too. Why else would we be watching? Let's break down episode 6, which boulders at the seams with sex, thugs, and Annalise Keating lying to the people she loves so they'll be swayed even further by the power of her protection. In flash forward land, 2 weeks later, catch up if you can, as ADA Emily Sinclair lies dead at the Hapstall mansion, Annalise is rushed into surgery, having been shot in the guts. The Keating four are in a getaway car with Nate, and last week we saw Asher flee the scene with Bonnie, then wander off to file a police report about whatever the F just happened as she scrubbed blood from her blouse in a gas station bathroom. Whew. But wait, where's our favorite con artist in a three-piece suit, the murderous yet impossibly darling Frank? Please don't let her die. Never trust what a hitman says in the presence of a hospital security camera. Is this the first time we've seen Fancy Frank act as anything less than 100% devoted to his boss? Bursting onto the scene at the last minute to establish an alibi, he urges Annalise's doctors to go for the gold, then returns to his car, totally emotionless, before casually dumping Catherine Hapstall's body in the Greenlight District. Unlike most of the girls Frank disposes in the forest, though, this one's still alive. In the land of real time. Tell me everything, and I'll fix it. In a flurry of deceit and cunning that would take many loose legal terms and violent vodka swigs to explain, Annalise basically ensures she'll keep Asher Millstone both clueless and close by cutting off his will to testify against the group and ruining his father's career before the corrupt judge can ruin hers first. To be fair, the Lady Keating had that big ol' envelope of evidence against the senior Millstone long before she had handpicked his son to work at her firm, so it was only a matter of time before she used it to either blackmail or save the befuddled Sir Doucheface. The fact that Annalise gets to protect all of her loyal subjects and cult followers in the process? Huge turn on. Worth the world, really. Now, shunned from his family, Ash will need her more than ever. Beware of Sinclair. Eager to get Asher off the hook as a witness in Sam's murder trial, Annalise threatens to paint the ADA as an overzealous law-breaking bitch, desperate to take her down. Which she is, for the record, but it takes one to know one. Why? Beats me? Jealousy? Egomania? Racism? Annalise trails off on the no-no word in evil delight, assuming her perky mortal enemy will cower in fear. But unlike an expensive bottle of liquor on a frigid autumn evening, Emily Sinclair does not take well to being handled. She leaks Asher's Lake Trotter history to the press, then forces another stuffed envelope of evidence on his special lady friend Bonnie against her will. The truth hurts Bon Bon more than Sinclair could possibly know or care. Asher was involved in the gang rape of Tiffany Howard. Take the cobbler, leave the attitude. In the most dramatic sequence of love hating each other across a closed door to date, Nate refuses to have anything to do with Annalise after the death of his cancer-ridden wife, Nia. But then he lets her in, pleading with his eyes and tum-tum for more of the peach cobbler she left behind all those hours ago. Lost in a confounding goop of both guilt and relief, Nate admits he administered the kill pills to Nia himself. They both know it's what his wife wanted, but the compassion stops there. Nate blames Annalise for stealing the only time he and Nia had left together, so no cobbler or apologies could fix that. I think he's lying here and did try the cobbler and loved it, but I guess that's not the point. Annalise's tears somehow make their way underneath the fearless lawyer's nose, a classic Keating move, as Nate jabs her where it really hurts. I don't hate you, he claims. I just don't care about you. Still pretty sure he's lying, and thinking about her cobbler. I'm never leaving you, Wes. The hits keep coming, and another of their incredibly tense and somewhat sexual are-they-aren't-they really mother and son conversations, Annalise lies to Wes that she still doesn't know what happened to Rebecca, and she understands why he's pulling away. Your mother leaves now, Rebecca, so understand why you can't trust me. Huh? What does his mom have to do with it? Is Annalise his real mom? And if so, who is the woman who committed suicide when Wes was 12? No more secrets, Annalise promises under the soft ripple of Wes's dismal apartment. Then she immediately calls Frank, who's finally getting rid of Rebecca's body for good. Well done, boss. Superbly handled. Oliver twists too far. Connor's lovable hacker boyfriend is in danger after going above and beyond his usual pro bono work. The new suspect in the Half-Cell murder case, the racist Aunt Helena's biological son, Philip, now 26 and living 2 miles away, don't even ask, is now creepily watching Oliver and Connor on a live feed as they're hacking him. This does not bode well for poor Ollie. If the show insists on killing him off, I hope he gets put on the Keating and Associates payroll for at least that final day. And then, in a stunning twist, Annalise can nestle him in her pocket of protection, her magnificent dusty blue coat, and everything will be alright. Come in, give her the bread! Upset that Laurel thinks he's capable of murder even though it's basically his only job requirement, Frank takes Laurel home to meet the real him. The kind of part of the real him, not the killer part. Whatever though, right? Lila Stangard was so last season. I love meeting Frank's very loud, very loving, and almost surely mafioso family. Laurel's enthralled, too, that her sex toy is being so human-like, hoisting up the kiddos, kissing his grandma, and gazing fondly at her mom-approved lack of cleavage across the dinner table. I very much want to trade lives with Laurel when Papa Delfino pounds the kitchen table from his wheelchair and demands she plop down right next to him and start shoveling in the carbs. Booze and bread, and your man might have feelings. The girl could get used to this. The part about my butt. Is that true? Not that anyone really cares about the Half-Cell twins, but Caleb and Michaela, who are begging for their names to be combined into one, but I'm not going to go there, could turn into a real item. He approves of her gossip about what he's packing in the back, and she's still itching for from disgust or maybe something worse after sleeping with Aang's 911, so she could use the distraction. Plus, they're both adopted, and he might have killed his parents. What could go wrong? Fonka Jensen returns next week's episode of How to Get Away with Murder. It gets steamier, and more backstabby. Yay! Nonsense words. My favorite. Is there anything worse than rejected cobbler? Should Michaela follow through on her empty threat to serial kill Wes? And did anyone else imagine that insanely long Nexplanon arm plant birth control commercial during this week's episode was narrated by Daria? Okay, that's the end of the recap. I have no idea what the heck that last part was, but thank you, Annie Barrett from www.refinery29.com. That was an awesome recap. I enjoyed it. Oh, you guys did too. So once again, I definitely apologize for the lateness of this podcast. It actually has delayed me 2 days now because it's been super busy and super crazy, but I'm trying to pipe this darn thing out so you can at least get it a day in advance, as if you guys are really just on the edge of your seats just waiting for these episodes to come out anyway. Let's get into the comments on this episode. We'll start with the flash forward into the future. I was a little scandalized by Frank's smile when he left the emergency room going, oh my god, don't let her die! And then it looked like he was smiling, or was that a smirk? A smirk smile? Smirk, whatever. I don't know. It just kind of shocked me, and I was like, okay, I'll reserve judgment. I know how this show is. And then he gets in the car, and Catherine is in the back of his car, and what? And she's all cold and dead, and I'm just thinking, okay. Alright, I'm not going to panic. I'm just going to wait it out, see what the heck happened. And then we go from Catherine's dead body to steamy sex with Laurel and Frank. But as weird as that was, it'll never, ever, ever, ever beat the Wes Rebecca and Lila autopsy scene, the sex intercut autopsy scene. That just, yep, that has to be the most awkward sex scene on this show. And I'm just going to have to ask, why do people think they can sneak behind Frank's back and spy on his phone or steal his keys? I mean, he knows everything. He's like a mom who has eyes, like, in the back of his head, his hands, his ass. I don't know. Dude just knows everything and what's going on always. So I don't know why they keep thinking they can sneak behind them. Rookie mistakes, guys, and you keep making them all the time. And of course, Laurel says the suitcase of money has nothing to do with Rebecca. Then becomes all curious and, you know, we should have known that she would be the first to try to find out the details, even though she was all annoyed with Wes in last episode. Tell him, just stop. Except that I'm going to snoop up my boyfriend after I finish banging him. Whatever. Michaela, I don't know about her sure choice of words, and they're all doing that furious stage whisper. And Michaela says to Wes, and I guess the group is like, or I will serial kill you. I mean, stupid word choice, or was it just a very ham-fisted, heavy-handed line for the writers? Come on, guys, that was just a little much. Laying it on thick. How to get away with murder, but not with really heavy-handed writing. And I liked what Annalise was saying. You're so used to me doubting you, to Bonnie, that you can't see when you've done something right. Well, she's right about that. Too bad Bonnie actually didn't do anything. She obviously doesn't know Annalise showed this video of her father abusing her. Now, I'm going to credit this theory that I'm about to talk about to Steph Z of AfterBuzz. I only listened to AfterBuzz's How to Get Away with Murder show after I record my episodes, because of course I don't want to take any of their theories or their thoughts or predictions from their show and bleed it into my podcast. So that's also, you know, it delays me in listening to their podcast goodness because I haven't finished mine. So I haven't, you know, I only have what they had from the episode before in my mind and not what they know about this episode. But Steph C was saying that possibly the voice that we heard was not indeed Bonnie's dad, but could have been Frank. And maybe this video was made up, and that girl was just somebody, some kid, and this video was just made up so that Asher would just be so upset by this video that he wouldn't testify against Annalise and Bonnie. So I thought that was a pretty good theory, and it's plausible. I wouldn't put it past Annalise and Frank to be saving their asses like this, but it doesn't seem like they clued Bonnie into this whole idea, so that's a little strange, but it's a good theory. Thought I'd throw it out there. I thought Asher was going to word vomit about Annalise showing him the video about Bonnie's youth when they were having that awkward exchange in the kitchen, but he said he was sorry about her, what she endured in her youth. I was just hoping he would say something so we knew if it was the truth, but doesn't look like he brought it up. But maybe he's just a little more secretive because of Trotter Lake, but I was just hoping he would spew it so I figure out if this was true or not about Bonnie's youth, but I guess we'll find that out in the future. So we get to the case of the week, and Jill decided during her phone conversation with Annalise that she would use what Annalise told her over the phone about the struggle and just make up and exaggerate the scene. And for once, Annalise wasn't even trying to spin a plot, and she ended up influencing the murder anyway. And Jill called her over a landline. I mean, who has a landline anymore? Anybody want to raise their hand at home? The detective that said that Jill may have killed her husband because he found out what you are is just awful. But sadly, this isn't just some sort of good idea for drama, like some plot line. This probably would be something that would happen in real life and probably has happened in the transgender community. And it's awful, and I'm thankful that the writing team decided to take on this very timely and important issue in this show And it actually brought me to something that Jill brings up when she's in the room being questioned by Annalise. She brings up a case when she said she had to exaggerate the scene because of someone who was transgender and that was tried and sent to a men's prison, even though she was transgender and identified as a woman. And it was the case of C.C. McDonald. And I looked around to see what this case was about and came across something from, it was called From a Roadmap for Change in 2014. And there were a lot of writers. It was from Columbia Law School. A lot of the writers from Center for Gender Equality, Sexual Law. And they actually have an excerpt directly from C.C. McDonald. I'm just going to go ahead and read it because I think it was the best. It was just to hear it from her mouth, or more like her type, and I'll go ahead and read it to you. I think it's a great story. It says, "As a black trans woman, I am used to facing discrimination based on gender identity and race. I've been stopped many times by officers who use inaccurate stereotypes to justify harassing me and my peers. The night of June 5th, 2011 was no different. I went out with friends to a grocery store, and on the way we were stopped by officers who had gotten a noise complaint in the area. In a neighborhood full of loud bars closing down, my friends and I knew all too well that these officers were racially profiling a group of black youth who were up to no good. They eventually stopped harassing us, and we continued toward the store until we passed a group of white people outside a bar who began spewing racial epithets at us. I know that exchanges such as these never end well, so my first instinct was to get away. As I turned, a woman who was yelling at us threw a drink at me. Discombobulated, I turned back as she broke the glass on my face. Blood ran into my eyes and mouth, and she grabbed my hair. I did not fight, thinking I might worsen what had been done to my face. Instead, I yelled for help from my friends who broke us up. With blood all over me, all I could focus on was getting to the grocery store to call the police. I reached the parking lot of the bar, and my friends yelled for me to turn around. With my ears still ringing, I finally heard them in time to turn and find a man from the same group chasing me. He threw two bottles at my head and missed. When he wasn't satisfied with that, he continued walking toward me. My first reaction was to scare him away, so I pulled scissors from my purse. Instead, this made him angrier and he tried to grab my hair, so I defended myself. I was being attacked, and I stood my ground. Every day, I have to live with the fact that I took another person's life. This is hard for me to accept, no matter how evil they were. This does not change the fact that every person should have a right to protect themselves when they are in danger. Unfortunately, the criminal justice system does not take this into account with minority groups. Police officers use many stereotypes of black trans people to dehumanize me, such as assuming that I am a sex worker. I've been interrogated while standing at a bus stop because I looked like another black trans person police were looking for. So this treatment is nothing new to me. When police arrived, they saw a white man on the ground and a black trans person with scissors. They chose to not see the blood from my wounds and kept me from the ambulance nearby. I had complications with my face for weeks after the incident because of the improper treatment. Anyone who does not realize that our judicial system affects a hugely disproportionate number of people of color is living under a rock. People of color and trans people are seen as unfit for society and are therefore targeted by our justice system. Regardless of how I looked in court, my peers, a jury including only two people of color, were going to see me as a black trans person. Many cases of self-defense in my area have been thrown out by a district attorney when they involve a white person defending her or his life against a person of color. However, they chose to prosecute me, and brought up my past indiscretions, including a bounce check to further incriminate me. They even tried me on a second murder charge in case they couldn't find me guilty on the first. They placed me in holdings according to their definition of my anatomy instead of my gender identity. It would not allow professionals to come and speak about violence against trans women in prisons. But that is not why I speak out today. I do not want to sensationalize my story as a black trans woman in prison. I was one of the millions of people who are wrongfully put in jail, many of whom will never have the opportunity to tell their story. I went through the same struggles of oppression and depression with many others. I was not a trans woman in prison. I was a person in prison. Many who are seen as unfit for society are funneled into jails by our biased system. I speak out for those whom the justice system has failed, and there are far too many of us. This is why it is important that we reform the criminal justice system, period, to stop the biased policing and unfair sentencing of all minority groups, including LGBT people. So, I thought that was a very pertinent and important story to read and gave some clarification of what Jill was talking about. So, I hope that was educational for all of us, and we will get back into the comments for this episode. So Levi got shipped back to Georgia to live out his jail sentence. Apparently he's been busted for drugs before. I still think we see him return. I mean, after people find out Rebecca's missing, he's got to come back, right? Come on. Someone has to find out that one of Annalise's former clients suddenly disappeared off the face of the planet, especially someone who was accused once of killing the mistress of her dead husband. Come on, it's gotta come back. Catherine just left her tablet that was obviously recording the Keating Five. I mean, it's so obvious, man. Maybe she didn't care, or she was making the obvious point that she had a right to know what they were saying and doing behind her brother's back. I mean, can't say I blame her for doing it, though. But I love how Asher is all like, I'm totally excluded from these fools messing things up, right? Record stuff, getting caught and all that. You know, I'm not included, right? Right? I thought this guy, he's cute sometimes. Anyway, so Annalise drops off a peach cobbler from Nate after she finds out Nia died. But why did he smile when she left and he was like all lurking behind his closed door? I often watch the show the second or third time with my mom, and she assumed it was because he still loved her a bit, but we'll see about that later. I can understand Michaela's personal bias about sniffing out the birth parents of Caleb and Catherine since she's adopted, but she needs to be thinking like a lawyer. Well, she finally gets her O-face on, and she can only think with her vagina and how she wants Caleb all up in it. And her blaming Wes for making them all paranoid. Okay, maybe I won't blame her for that. That might be kind of true. And then Frank just goes and lies straight to Laurel and Wes's face. But is anyone surprised about that? No. Hush money for Rebecca, right? I mean, who's willing to bet Rebecca would have taken the money and ran? And just dissed Wes. I mean, yeah, I think she loved him, but come on, that was a lot of money. I might take that and run. Maybe even for my family. I don't know how I feel about Jill getting a TA to lie for her, saying that she saw Steven beating her, but hey, Annalise liked the idea, so guess it'll work. Maybe it was a good idea. Except, nope. Turns out, it didn't work. Cops decide to bring up the over a minute long conversation that Jill has with Annalise over the landline. Again, with the landline. I'm not sure how many people call their lawyers before they call 911, but my untrained mind would probably, as a juror, would think that only someone guilty or worried about how they would look at a crime would do something like that. Now let's get to poor Asher thinking that all this corruption his dad has been involved in could stay covered if he wants to get Sinclair off his trail over Tiffany. It's really naive of him, but he'll get over it. He does need to grow up. Especially when we see that Annalise uses Millstone Senior's corruption to get Jill free, using dirt to free her client. Nice tactical move and a way to show us how absolute power corrupts absolutely, because I believe that is so true. Now, do you find Steven's murder justified? Was he really aiming to kill, or did he almost kill her that day? Would he have eventually killed Jill from beating her so often? It's a little ambiguous since we never see him alive, but it's heavily suggested, and I think the implication is we're more likely to sympathize and believe Jill. Not saying that we shouldn't, but I think those are valid questions to think about. So, in the whole Hafstall family, there's a secret baby, the son of the dead aunt. Now, did the son kill the aunt or his mom? Did he want to get the money of his own accord because he needed it and was tired of waiting on it? Or was the money she was giving to him for support not enough? What was his motive exactly? Now, the Michaela-Caleb guilt and ass exchange was weird. I mean, it seemed oddly abrupt. Or did that attraction just happen when she defended Caleb over them trying to seek out his birth parents? Whatever it is, I don't know, it's awkward. Back to Nate and Annalise. Nate's harsh words about not caring about Annalise, just ouch. But I mean, are they ultimately true? Maybe partially. And he gave his wife the pills. Did he get those pills himself, or was that what they exchanged a few episodes ago? I'm still obsessing over that weird hand exchange when he put his hand in his coat after they touched hands. I don't know, but Annalise really did steal the time they had left by framing him. I mean, it's pretty messed up. And no one is ever going to feel the same about Annalise the way he felt about Nia. Maybe. She keeps backstabbing people like that. Maybe Eve will feel that way? Nah, she backstabbed her already. And Wes has become the lurker Bonnie used to be. He's all lurking there when Annalise and Nate are talking. I guess somebody has to take up the lurker role. Bonnie's not a wallflower anymore, and now she's in the front. So I guess somebody's got to be creepy. And now we get something creep. Frank invites Laurel to meet his family, and they were hilarious. It was cute. Let's move on. Oliver decided he wanted to hack even further and found the secret baby who is now a 26-year-old man named Philip Jessup, who doesn't live far from the Hapsalls and is watching a live feed of Oliver and Connor talking about him. I am now very scared that Oliver is not going to live through this season or the next, and that's going to suck because he is adorable. I'm gonna refer to Steph Z again from AfterBuzz because there's a theory she always brings up. A lot of us have given her crap about thinking that Annalise is Wes's mom, but the weird exchange at the end in Wes's apartment where they're all kind of yelling and stuff kind of makes her theory plausible, but I really hope she's wrong still. And Frank is just now getting to correctly burying Rebecca's body. Damn, just cremate the girl. Cremate the chick already. Jeez. Wait. But what? Frank planted Catherine's not dead but sleeping body in the woods where a cop finds her. I was baffled as to why that would happen. This is where my mom came in with a good theory. She thinks the blood on Catherine's nightgown is Annalise's. They're going to pin the murder on Catherine. Since Frank was seen pleading with the doctors to please not let Annalise die. Maybe he was giving himself a somewhat decent alibi. And then now Caleb is he in on the plan though? Because he was at Michaela's apartment that night and was like, is she okay? So who is he referring to? Does he know what's going on? Is he against Catherine now? What's up with that? Also, I want to know if Philip Jessup has somehow come into play by the time Catherine's awakening in the woods. I mean, somehow in the mess of the recent shootings and such. I don't know. Apparently we have 2 episodes left until we find out who shot Annalise. So, sorry guys, it took me so long to get this podcast out. Like I said, hectic, very hectic week, followed by Halloween, and next week the episode might be delayed too. Going on vacation. Got a lot of stuff going on, but I'll see what I can do. I don't know if you guys are really clamoring for the episode, but we'll see. So guys, getting your feedback for the upcoming episode 7 of How to Get Away with Murder. Some of your feedback, your thoughts, any positive, negative thoughts on this podcast. You can send your feedback and everything to howtogetawaywithlaw@gmail.com. Send a tweet at getawaywithlaw. Or search out the Facebook group. Search out How to Get Away with Law. Just comment there, whatever. Just you can attach an audio file, an email, or just type out an email. Just communicate with me, folks. And if you'd be so kind, go to iTunes and rate and please comment and give an honest review. 1 to 5 stars, but I like 5 stars. And just get the word out there to your friends, family, loved ones about the podcast and get them watching How to Get Away with Murder because it's a great show. We should be talking about it. So until next time, guys, please don't go getting away with murder, but definitely watch How to Get Away with Murder.